organization called the Guardian Angels. You see them with red berets.
I admire Curtis Sliwa, and I think that he takes his life into his own hands doing what he does.
Curtis Sliwa, the Guardian Angels founder and leader.
We've got Curtis Sliwa from WABC Radio.
Curtis Sliwa, legendary New York.
The Drive at 5 with Curtis Sliwa. What happened today? Why? And what's next? Live, local, on it. 77 WABC.
As we are high at our Madison Square Garden, the great facilities provided to us in order to do this broadcast to all of you by NJDiet.com, and the hawk is talking out there. Although, if you listen to Bill Evans, it'll be lovey-dovey as you canoodle through St. Valentine's Day on Wednesday. But the big story coming out of Washington, D.C. was the president announced that this would be the biggest infrastructure deal of all time. That's right, of all time.
This morning I submitted legislative principles to Congress that will spur the biggest and boldest infrastructure investment in American history. The framework will generate an unprecedented $1.5 to $1.7 trillion investment in American infrastructure. We're going to have a lot of public-private. And that way it gets done on time, on budget.
$1.5 trillion, $1.7 trillion. Let me see. It just busted the budget in order to raise the debt ceiling $300 billion each year for the next 2 years. Where are we going to get this money? But hey, sounds good so far, right? And the president promised, as a result of this spending, $1.5 to $1.7 trillion on capital improvements in infrastructure, there will be jobs, jobs, jobs.
It will create thousands and thousands of jobs and increase training for our great American workers. And it returns power to the state and local governments who know best what their people need. Washington will no longer be a roadblock to progress. Washington will now be your partner. We'll be your partner.
Washington will be your partner. I would say if Washington is your partner, watch that your partner doesn't pick your pockets. Because that's what politicians do. But then the president conjured up one of his, I would say, top shelf five-star moments as a builder, as a mogul here in New York City. When he came to the rescue of Woolman's Rink, which was in dismal shape during the Ed Koch years, and took it over, rehabbed it, and then ran it and continues to run it right there at the entrance to Central Park.
When I did the Woolman Rink, it was 7 years. They couldn't get it built. It would have been forever. They couldn't get it built. And I did it in a few months at a much smaller price. They had invested $12 million in building an ice skating rink in the middle of Central Park. Somebody told me about this the other day. They've never forgotten it. Was a big deal at the time. It remains a big deal.
It was and continues to be. Donald Trump tried to pimp off of that and convince Ed Koch that he would rehab the Williamsburg Bridge at that time. But Ed Koch said, no, that's quite all right. You've already shown me up and made me look weak. But let's get an idea of what this is going to mean for specifically the state of New Jersey, the state of New York, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, which have major infrastructure needs, especially the Gateway Tunnel. From Jonathan Salant, he's the D.C. correspondent for the Star Ledger. Thanks for joining us again here on the Drive Home at 5, Jonathan.
Anytime.
Okay, so you've had a chance to bisect and dissect the president's proposal today?
Yes.
Okay, and right out of the box, what does it do, if anything, for the Gateway Tunnel that we desperately need, the new link between New Jersey and Manhattan?
Well, by all indication, it's going to make it harder because there's a cap on how much the federal government will spend on its share of Gateway. It's one of the programs in the budget that the Gateway proponents were counting on tapping is going to be closed off to Gateway. And it's not $1.5 trillion, it's $200 billion. The other $1.3 to $1.5 trillion is private investment. It's state investment. It's local investment. Already New York and New Jersey have agreed to pay half the cost, but this will cap the federal share to 20%, not 50%.
Okay, so if there's that much private investment, that's a sizable amount, investors expect a return on their investment. how would they possibly get that? Because obviously when the federal government or state government put money into a project, the return is that, in this instance, the commuters get more mass transit or better highways or better ways to get around.
The problem is that if it's a private investor, they want a certain rate of return. In Washington, D.C., where I live, we have several private toll roads now, and they get us guaranteed a certain amount of return, and they can charge whatever they want to get that return. Chuck Schumer, the senator from New York, is calling it Trump tolls and says on a lot of the highways they want to put tolls on, that's how they're going to raise some of the money. It could be through the fare box. It could be through putting restaurants on rest areas on the interstates that don't have them now, like the Long Island Expressway, like Interstate 80 in New Jersey, like the Interstate 287. The Connecticut Turnpike has them, but some of the other highways don't have rest areas or rest areas, you know, for bathrooms. They can put restaurants on them and use some of that revenue.
Okay. Obviously, the president trying to get a bit creative in terms of how to pay for these major projects. But for instance, as we travel around the tri-state area, we have so many bridges. Bridges that may predate, in some instances, our Civil War. I don't believe they're going to be putting tolls on those. I'm talking the much smaller bridges that would connect you, let's say, over a creek, over a river, but obviously in disrepair, because you see the yellow cones everywhere. You see tape that says you can't pass over this bridge any longer. How would repair of those bridges be subsidized?
Well, that's one of the arguments against the Trump plan, is that there isn't going to be a lot of money for those, that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the trucking associations are calling for gas taxes or other taxes to bring more money into the system. Right now, the highway fund, highway trust fund that pays a lot of these constructions, is running a debt because they're not raising enough money. Fewer people are driving. Those who are driving using more fuel-efficient cars, and if you're driving an electric car, you're not paying any gas tax.
All right. So in this particular case, Jonathan Salant, anyone coming up with a new idea, as this is a new idea, new infrastructure development that would include a state partnership, county partnership, private partnership with the feds not kicking in as much as they used to in the past, you would have to show examples of how this works. Are there any key projects that the president was referring to as sort of a jump start, as a first of something we can look at and know in a year or two? Wow, the president was right. It's actually moving quickly, and it's efficient, and it's cost effective.
He hasn't given any specifics like that, but he did talk about, like, for example, in Washington, there are two parkways that the government owns. He talked about selling those off. He talked about selling the airports down here that the government owns. He talks about, not in New Jersey, New York, but there are other parts of the country that have government power authority. He talks about selling those off and using raising money that way and letting the private sector or combination of state and local run that and pay those expenses.
Now, I am salivating at what you just said, Jonathan Salant, because, you know, the biggest boondoggle we have, the biggest house of patronage, is the Port Authority, shared by the state of New Jersey, New York. It doesn't matter who the governor is of either state. They appoint their cronies. They spend massive amounts of money. And obviously, they keep raising fares and tolls astronomically. Was he making reference that we might bisect and dissect the Port Authority and then disperse it out for private ownership?
They could sell it. He didn't refer to the Port Authority because, again, that's not federal government owned. It's an independent authority. So I don't know that you'll can take solace in the president's comments about selling off the Washington airports, which the federal government owns, compared to the airports in the New York area.
Oh, but you would have to acknowledge that if we could spin off LaGuardia, JFK, Newark International Airport, and actually sell it to private entrepreneurs, private corporations, what a tremendous less of a burden it would be for us, the taxpayers, who have to subsidize the state-run Port Authority.
Well, some of the one of the proposals does make it easier to privatize airports. Right now, you need like 65% of the airlines to vote for it, and now you need a small, I think, just majority rule on that. So, if you wanted to privatize airports, it might be easier.
Now, I thought that infrastructure development would bring both sides together. As partisan, as bitter as it's been, we were told, boy, infrastructure, it'll have Democrats, Republicans howling in the night in cooperation, singing Kumbaya. Based on what you've said, it doesn't appear that way, does it?
Well, both sides want to repair the infrastructure. The question always becomes, how do you pay for it? Do you raise $1 trillion or $1.5 trillion through a gas tax, through a car tax, through a truck tax, or do you raise it through inviting the private sector in, letting them take over Interstate 80 and putting tolls on it, and then getting back the money that way while they pay for repairs? Remember that Vice President Mike Pence, when he in Indiana, they sold the Indiana toll road to a private investor, and they're getting all the tolls that now in New York State Thruway goes to the Thruway Authority, and on the bridges goes to the Port Authority or the Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority.
I do appreciate that. That's Jonathan Salant, D.C. correspondent for the Star-Ledger, who has wet my beak when I'm thinking of the Bridge and Tunnel Authority, right? Getting rid of that. The MTA, right? Get rid of the MTA, the money-taking agency, which is so ineffective in running our mass transportation system. Metro North up to Westchester, upstate New York, Connecticut. The Long Island Railroad, obviously out to the far ends of Suffolk. The subway system, the bus system here that services the five boroughs. I mean, consider the ramifications. And I'm very open-minded to this, especially when it comes to the Port Authority. Their mismanagement of the airports have turned JFK and LaGuardia, especially into third-world airports, and Newark bordering on that. I'll be very interested to see how this Trump plan works out, and especially since he's comparing it to a successful conversion of the Woolman Rink into a project that suddenly was resurrected, was operational, functional, and profitable.
Curtis Sliwa.
He's a man of the people.
Between the Scylla and Charybdis of commentary.
The Drive at 5, 77 WABC.
Now I'm gone to Rikers Island. You never want to go to Rikers Island.
As we continue here on the Drive Home at 5. So I'm watching over and over ad nauseum this video that shows a bunch of homies as they bum rush two correctional officers. And they cold cock one, and down he goes. The other guy just seems to be looking, the correctional officer. Then there are other two correctional officers who come to the rescue. They pull out the spray. It backs off the thugs. It turns out that they're bloods. And it's mishigash. More violence, more anarchy that seems to be taking place in the buildings that house inmates at Rikers Island. On the line to discuss it, as we've had him before, is Reuven Blau. He's reporter for New York's hometown newspaper, The Daily News. Thanks for jumping on board the Drive Home at 5 again, Reuven.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, well, first off, I see these guys were arraigned. What can we call them, the Rikers Island 5? How many of them were there?
There were five younger inmates who are all alleged blood members. Led by one, Stephen Espinal, who is facing murder charges. Apparently, he was upset at the officer for giving him a ticket due to some prior infraction and orchestrated the beatdown.
Okay. So, from the video, he just launches this attack on the correctional officer, knocks him down. But I noticed the other correctional officer who had been sitting in there was sitting on a seat with a desk in front of him. He appeared to be impotent, didn't seem to do anything. Was I right by that observation?
Yeah, some editors here as well made that same point, and somebody asked the union president about it yesterday, and he just kind of said no comment. In his defense, it happens very quickly, and, it's a possibility that he just, kind of was just sort of shocked by what was going on.
Right, but, Reuven, wasn't it your report, it had to do with Thanksgiving Day, was a captain, he was making the rounds, and an African-American inmate who had some dreadlocks, he attacked him, remember? And his own partner didn't even jump in, meaning the correctional officer's partner. It's like, if the inmates know that the correctional officers are not going to back one another up when they're getting attacked, then it's almost like all-out free season in attacking correctional officers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a danger and a hazard. I think with that other case that you're referencing, yeah, that definitely did also jump out as me as well. And there's video of that, and it seems a little bit more obvious in that case, where it almost seems like there's other officers on that floor, and they almost sort of slink backwards. And in that case, the department actually did take action. I believe they suspended these two officers. And there was sort of a large, you know, it's unproven, but there was sort of a belief that they might have sort of been warned about it or, you know, been part of the whole thing.
Now, normally, if an inmate, whether they were young like these teenagers or older, if they were causing problems years ago, they would have been sent to the Bing segregation. They're in an 8x4-foot cell by themselves, 23 hours a day, an hour of recreation. They don't do that anymore, do they?
No, they stopped that gradually under the de Blasio administration. There's been a sort of a national push to sort of reduce or limit the use of solitary confinement. And studies have shown that, you know, it can really be damaging long term. And they've also showed that it not, you know, necessarily works to sort of prevent some of this violence. But in the, you know, in the flip side, the union argues that, look, this is something, a necessary tool. And somebody acts out, they need to be separated, and they need to have that toolbox, you know, used in a, you know, in a moderate way, and they, you know, there's a lot of frustration that they don't have that ability right now.
Well, what do they do as an alternative? If inmates are acting up, what recourse do the correctional officers have to let them know that, you know, they're in charge?
So that's a great question. When they enacted this, they created this special housing unit, this transitional housing unit for inmates who do act out, younger inmates especially, and they were given in this unit sort of special attention, added programs and counseling. And believe it or not, this last incident on Saturday actually occurred in that unit, where these inmates had previously acted out, were sent to for the additional sort of programming and help and assistance, and then they acted out again.
Now, does the mayor actually visit Rikers Island? Does he actually get up close and personal and talk with both the inmates and the correctional officers? Because every day in the daily news, there are stories of not just correctional officers being attacked, but inmates claiming that correctional officers have abused them.
Yeah, that's a great question. He's made a couple trips. He's done a few press conferences there. You know, but generally speaking, it's not a routine, you know, occurrence. I mean, he gets briefed by the commissioner. His wife actually has made multiple trips as well. But, you know, he's not there on a regular basis.
Do appreciate that. You know, I would suggest this for the mayor. You know, most of the housing is dormitory style. At least that's where he stuck me. 40 guys, 40 gavones in a large room. You know, you got a bunk. And then there's one, usually a smaller African-American woman correctional officer, and she's got a body alarm. And if everybody bum rushes her, she pulls the body alarm, and then the tactical support team comes in. They're all armored down. They're swinging and winging. But maybe the mayor should be forced, you know, to cop a squat at night in one of those dorms. This way he can rap with his inmates, right? Get their point of view. And then maybe have breakfast in the morning in a cafeteria where you can have two servings of breakfast like the correctional officers who, to be honest with you, I don't understand why they would ask for two servings of that breakfast on Rikers Island.
Curtis Sliwa.
The next mayor of the city of New York.
Drive at 5.
Curtis Sliwa, legendary New Yorker.
77 WABC.
542, as we continue here on the drive home at 5. And the president was tweeting away on Saturday, and he was professing concern for Rob Porter, who had left the West Wing, and one of his speechwriters. And then, in almost like a muse, he was saying, whatever happened to due process? And I said to myself, gee, I really don't think our president really understands due process. Lock her up, lock her up, lock her up, the Central Park Five, you know, all that. But I'm not necessarily sure if I totally understand due process. So we need a little help here from Michael Metzner. Meltzner, he's a professor of constitutional law at Northeast University and author of With Passion, an Activist Lawyer's Life. Thanks for joining us, Mike.
Hey, Curtis, I think you understand due process very well. The president is plainly up to his game of distracting and deflecting. He seems to forget that he didn't have much in the way of due process for the Central Park Five or for Hillary Clinton. And so he's discovered it as a way of trying to avoid perhaps the fact that so many women have complained about him. due process is really two different sets of principles. One is of a legal construct, and it's the law of due process, and it's evoked when we want to protect someone's liberty or property in a court or in a hearing, administrative hearing of some sort. And it's the kind of procedures that we use to reach reliable findings that you know from the Bill of Rights. An independent decision maker, the right to face your accusers, the right to testify, and so forth. That's due process as a matter of law. But there's another kind of due process, which is really a cultural thing. It's what happens in the public square when we learn things. It's public opinion. And in the case of Rob Porter, we've been presented with all sorts of evidence that's enough for people to form opinions, just the way they did with Kevin Spacey and Harvey Weinstein. There are photographs, there are FBI reports, there are documents, there are three women complaining. Due process of that sort is not deaf, dumb, and blind, as I have written.
Now, Michael, the first time I heard it is when defendants were complaining. They got busted for drugs and for possession of money, supposedly from drug dealing, and immediately the authorities came in and threw civil forfeiture. They took everything. And their lawyers in court were saying, federal court, what about due process? How could you take every person here's money and all their resource when they haven't been found guilty of anything yet?
Well, I agree that that's the kind of due process that we should all defend, whether we like the people who are being charged or not, because it's a way of reaching a reliable decision before someone's liberty or property is taken. That's not what's involved in the present sexual assault and harassment allegations. The president calls them mere allegations, but there are all sorts of facts out there, and we don't have to make ourselves stupid when we hear them and learn them from reliable sources. That's a different kind of due process, a kind of cultural sense. Yes, you want to be fair about reaching conclusions, but there's plenty of evidence out there that we can decide about. If Porter or Trump or anybody is hailed before a judicial or administrative or a congressional hearing, they are certainly, like the defendants you're talking about, entitled to every procedural right before something is taken away from them.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Michael Melchner, that we here in talk radio are constantly guilty of not allowing people due process. We find them guilty as judge, jury, and executioner every day here at WABC and every talk radio station in the nation. And I plead guilty to that. But, you know, the rest of my colleagues will say, oh, no, we're fair and square, bull feathers.